This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Hey, Mike, you sound a little husky there, baby.
That's my sexy voice. You like it?
That's husky.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, straight from Martha's Vineyard, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, you sound a little husky there, baby.
That's my sexy voice. You like it?
That's husky.
We are taping this on Monday this week, and we still haven't had yet the Rick Hess versus Randy Weingarten discussion, which is going to, I'm sure, be very exciting on many fronts, but including this sexy voice that I get to use.
Nice. Well, you know, that's why I was up Martha's Vineyard. I was prepping with the president. He was saying, hey, here's a couple of things to make sure to chat about with Randy.
Yep.
He's a big fan.
Hey, so, you know, supposedly according to Stephen Brill's book, which I know you're a big fan of, Rick, Obama made sure he told Arnie Duncan about Race to the Top, just make sure we're not poking the unions in the eyes. I don't think they did so well following through on those orders, did they?
Well, I don't know. The first two winners had 100%, you know, had 100% union sign up.
Oh, woo! Yeah, that's right. That is true. That is true. What was your take on Martha's Vineyard? Do you think generally Democratic presidents should not be going to the Vineyard? is it too easy to paint the whole elitist line?
Well, you know, it's funny. I would totally cut Democratic president slack on the whole Martha's Vineyard thing if the liberal media didn't get up in arms every time a Republican president went out to their ranch or went west.
Right.
You could just say, look, these guys work hard. We're going to cut them all a little slack.
Right.
But,
So who do you think would be more comfortable at Martha's Vineyard, Rick Perry or Mitt Romney? And what does that mean for their pros and cons of the president? Okay. One last thing, you know, that listeners may remember now about a year and a half ago, I wrote an article about Whole Foods Republicans, you know, saying that, hey, if Republicans want to attract the college educated voter, they need to elect people who are willing to be, not only smarter in issues, but also maybe have an academic background that's pretty strong. And I noticed that this weekend, Huntsman was trying to make some of these cases, you know, saying, hey, we can't have somebody who's anti-science, a la Rick Perry. I noticed that Huntsman is polling at about 3%.
Well,
so I see that my article did not create a groundswell for Whole Foods Republicans.
Well, I particularly like that Huntsman's strategy in the Republican primary seems to be blast all of his rivals as a bunch of nincompoops. Now, this might work well for Huntsman in the Democratic primary.
No. It could work well in New Hampshire. You get all those Democrats who cross over and vote for Huntsman in the New Hampshire primary. And then his campaign stops at that point. Okay. Hey, but this is not the politics gadfly. It's the education gadfly. Let's get started. We have intern Laura here to ask some questions. Intern Laura, let's get started.
All right. Thanks. So exactly what was Arnie Duncan thinking, or perhaps not thinking, when he went on attack against Texas's education record?
You know, Laura, we had written this in the script as what was Arnie Duncan smoking, and I'm a little disappointed that you went off on your own with the. No, just kidding. But Rick, I missed this. I was on vacation. What happened, lastly? What happened? What was he thinking?
This is a really interesting. The one domestic policy area where the administration can plausibly claim some bipartisan success, their choir boy cabinet secretary that gets, you know, good write-ups in the Wall Street Journal. And this is the guy who goes out and starts gratuitously bashing one of the Republican candidates 5 months before Iowa?
And not only bashing him, but to make the case that kids in Texas are doing poorly, or that we should feel sorry for them, or that the educational record in Texas is not very good. You know, you can have qualms with it, but, you know, kids in Texas are doing quite well compared to the rest of the country, especially minority kids, and especially compared to Illinois, much less Chicago, where Arnie Duncan's from. Well, we're not the first ones to point this out, of course.
I particularly liked that he was bashing Perry for dialing back school spending. This is 10 months after Duncan made a big point out of embracing the new normal and talking about how we were past the era of profligate education spending.
Yeah, that was a great speech at the American Enterprise Institute, which I think perhaps Duncan now is just pretending he never gave. He was just trying to make us happy on the right. Oh, well. This is problematic. You know, the last thing that those of us that support reforms, especially Common Core, which is delicate politically, but other things too, you know, that have been in the mainstream that have been bipartisan, is to have a big food fight over education in the 2012 election that becomes very ideological and that forces people on the left and right to go back to their camps. And, you know, I just worry that... you know, we have enjoyed, you know, that, look, you've made the case that maybe sometimes we have bipartisanship because the right has given up on a lot of these issues. But, you know, some of this stuff is just personal politics, mm-hmm. and it would be better if we didn't have it.
Well, I mean, it's crazy. There's other mouthpieces for Obama. You know, there's the governor of Maryland, who's head of the Democratic Governor Association, whose job is to go out and carry these fights. For a cabinet secretary who's charged with, you know, presumably the one area where there's bipartisanship, who's talking about trying to get NCLB Riyadh done with good feeling on both sides, it was just really peculiar to see him get out front like this.
Well, and supposedly his people are saying it was just a mistake.
Whoops.
He was not under orders or anything. It just slipped out of his mouth, although twice, because it was to Bloomberg and to C-SPAN.
I didn't mean I felt sorry for the kids of Texas. I meant I felt happy for the kids of Texas.
Okay, topic number two.
All right, Rick, you've been writing that we shouldn't be surprised by the snowballing cheating scandals. Why not?
You know, today also, news just came out that Arlene Ackerman is out in Philadelphia. Look, we've now seen...
Wait, and is that related to...
The cheating scandal, sure. Scandal. I mean, this stuff, yeah, absolutely. But we've now seen real substantial concerns in Atlanta, in Philadelphia, and in Washington. Look, we have been ramping up the consequences of these assessments for teachers and principals over the last decade. I think many of us have just been either inattentive or kind of assumed that we had stepped up test security in a commensurate fashion. Turns out we have paid zero attention to test security. And, you know, I think that the safest bet is that what we've started to see just from a couple of intrepid USA Today reporters and from a little bit of low-level maintenance is only going to be the front edge of what's going to turn out to be, you know, a pretty substantial amount of cheating. Because when you give people when you give people incentives to worry about performance and you don't do much to safeguard how they're going to be measured, what happens is you get cheating.
You know, this could be one of those black swan issues, those issues that, you know, was right there in front of all of us and we didn't pay attention to it and could have a big impact. You know, I remember when Greg Topo was starting some research on this series that USA Today was going to do on cheating. And, you know, I remember thinking, oh, come on, Greg, this is not a big deal. This has been done. This is, you know, overplayed. But hey, lo and behold, if it turns out that that we have not put the structures in place to guard against this, shame on us.
You know, it's the funniest thing for me. The most ironic thing is how this really, you know, goofs up both sides. For the teacher unions, who've kept explaining that teachers won't respond to incentives, don't care about accountability, they're just doing the right thing as best they can, it's kind of tough to argue when it turns out that lots of educators have actually gone ahead and, engaged in malfeasance. And for the reformers, the reason you do incentives accountability is because you don't just trust teachers to do the right thing all the time. So it's kind of interesting that people who put in place these incentives presume that people, that the teachers aren't heroic, would then go ahead and turn a blind eye at letting teachers hold on a test for 48 or 72 hours after getting the completed results back from their students.
Hey, by the way, in terms of doing the right thing, let's not assume that teaching to these tests that have been pretty crappy tests is necessarily doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, topic number three.
All right. At least 120 districts in 20 states have moved to four-day weeks. Is this as bad of an idea as it seems?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But now, I debated this issue on Fox last year with a very nice superintendent from Georgia, rural district in Georgia, who explained to me, look, we extend the day, those other 4 days, so the kids are getting just as much learning time, and our test scores are up. So if we're talking about innovation in education, why would we, I mean, Rick, you're Mr. Innovation, you're Mr. Think Outside the Box. This is thinking outside the box, right?
Sure. In fact, I'm holding out for the old two-day school week.
It's coming, and we're on our way.
Yeah, right, because then you get to shut down the buildings for 3 days a week. Look, I'm all about sensible, cost-effective measures, but A, the savings here are pretty minuscule. Anybody with a little bit of, with a little bit of steel in their spine can get much more substantial savings other than closing your schools 1 day a week.
Well, and cutting down on transportation. These are rural districts that, right, you know, kids are spending a long time on.
But almost entirely the savings. And it's a little bit of electricity. It's a little bit of meal prep. But, I mean, that's the bulk of it. Look. There's a reason that I think the research suggests that once you've done 15 or 20 minutes of instruction on a given activity, the kids' learning absorption kind of maxes out. It's because people's brains get tired. and we're talking about kids age 6 to 18, and you're talking about putting them in a building for 9, 10, 11 hours, I think you know what you wind up with is substantial trade-offs in terms of actual learning.
Well, what about KIPP, though? I mean, that's been the celebration of KIPP in some of these other schools is extended learning time.
Sure. But I mean, so the question then for KIPP is instead of trying to do this 9 to 5 and then half a day on Saturday over 6 days, you know, does KIPP get equally substantial results doing packing all that in going 9 to 7:30
But KIPP shows that kids can handle 9 to 5.
Oh, they can. But I mean, the question is, you know, if you're going to have kids in for 9 to 5, let's run 9 to 5, 5 days a week.
So, you know, here's another point, though, Rick. I mean, some of these districts, you're talking about rural districts, you know, getting kids to school. I mean, what if they say, look, we're going to use technology in interesting ways. We're going to do what people are talking about with flipping the instruction, like the Khan Academy, and say, look, we're going to have kids watch lectures at home, do as much as we can at home, and then when they're here at school, we're going to maximize what needs to happen in terms of interactivity. I mean, you could imagine a smart way of doing this that would save money, but also just might be more effective.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, what I haven't seen is many folks actually putting it out that way. I've seen most of them talking about it as a, you know, cost-saving device to minimize transportation. But sure, no, I mean, absolutely. But it's also the case that if that's true, then I still suspect that getting kids into school for shorter increments, 5 days a week, is probably educationally optimal. And B, I got to tell you, if I'm a parent with kids and having the district say to me, hey, you know what, in order to save a pretty minimal amount, we're going to throw you on your own 1 day a week in terms of getting your kids placed, I'm actually not sure that that's you know, particularly conducive.
Okay, that's all the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Rick. Now it's everyone's favorite time. It's Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
I understand you're actually going to take in some pop culture this week.
I'm going to see Train. Very excited, very excited. Hey, Soul Sister. You know, everybody knows that song.
Hey, Soul Sister.
Something.
Mister.
On the radio.
I know that song.
See?
I've been trying to listen to more pop culture, or at least more pop radio. Uh-huh. Like when I'm driving around with the kids, I ask Nico. I say, Nico, you want to rock out? And he says, yeah. And then I put on like the mix radio station. It's like all the pop hits. It's
cool.
Good.
Yeah, I'll be singing tomorrow. So I'm excited.
All right. Well, what you got for us today?
So we have a new report out by University of Missouri economist Corey Codell that examines grading standards and education departments at universities. So we have administrative grade data from the 07-08 academic year from three large public universities. They have enrollments of around 83,000 students. Codell analyzes classroom level grade reports from roughly 2,900 undergraduate classes, 665 of which were education courses. He compared classroom level average GPAs in the ed departments to 12 other departments, including math, science, economics, political science, history, and so forth. Big, unshocking finding. He finds that grades awarded by ed departments are substantially higher than the grades awarded by all other academic departments. In fact, education GPAs are 0.5 to 0.8 grade points higher than in other departments. University of Missouri, for instance, ed GPAs average 3.73, math, science, and econ classes 2.92, social sciences 3.03, humanities 3.12. Codell also analyzes similar data from a random draw of other ed schools, since this primary analysis was only three. He found the same pattern. He finds that differences cannot be explained by class size or student quality. Finally, his big kind of takeaway is that ed departments are contributing to a culture of low standards for educators, similar to what we've seen with teacher evaluations.
Shocked. I'm shocked.
Isn't that
shocking? You know, from my own personal anecdotal experience, this is certainly true. When I took ed school classes at the University of Michigan, I had some professors who admitted up front that basically they didn't believe in grading and everyone would be getting an A.
Wow. From day one, you knew you were getting an A.
Yeah, that was it. I got to love it. Because they did not want to try to be coercing us into,
that's right.
You know, they didn't believe in behavioralist approaches.
It's about enjoying learning.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Uh-huh. But I am a little surprised at 3.7 as the average.
Yeah, that's pretty high, isn't it?
That's amazing.
Yeah, well, it was University of Missouri, so kind of pulled that one out. But yeah, on average, 0.5 to 0.8 grade points higher.
But
so.
I mean, that means what? That 3.7 average means that almost everybody's getting an A.
An A.
And
right.
A few people are getting Bs.
Yeah, that's pretty much what that means.
So it's, and yes, yeah, so it is true, people, if you want to get an easy major, you take at school
class. Yeah, but apparently, I mean, to be fair, and he just kind of says this but doesn't really show the data, but I guess grade inflation is sort of rampant, you know, in universities, period, compared to, I guess, what we've seen traditionally in the past, but it just is aggravated in ed schools. So big old grade inflation problem. I mean, I thought he had an interesting solution. He said maybe university administrators should force ed schools to have this, you know, mandatory grade distribution, which I don't know about you, but I had professors that actually did that. You know, there's only going to be X percent. They're going to get A's and that's it.
Right. So. No, it's that's tough, but no, it makes some sense. Or at least, it's different if you say, well, somebody's going to have to get an F or a D or a C. Well, if people do the work, if they get the, you know, if they really do write good papers, et cetera, you don't want to force that on them. But yeah, basically to say the ed schools, this is embarrassing.
Yeah.
Okay, what's the song that goes along with this?
So since we're education students seem to sail through school, we have Sailing by Criss Cross.
Take me away.
This song, it's so good.
Well, it's not far down to paradise. At least it's not for me. If the wind is right, you can sail away and find tranquility. Oh, the canvas can do miracles. Just you wait and see. To never land, no reason to pretend. And if the wind is right, you can find the joy of innocence again. Oh, the canvas can do miracles. Just you wait and see. Believe me.
Time for What's Up With That?
Woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What up with that? Yes,
sir. Okay, welcome back, Chris. You know, Chris is such a dedicated Fordham employee, Rick, that on his vacation, he traveled to Fordham's hometown of Dayton, Ohio.
For what?
That's right, I did. The Fordham anniversary tour. No, I'm just kidding. I went down to Dayton and then into Mason, Ohio for the Western and Southern Open big tennis tournament that's down there.
So this wasn't related to Fordham business?
Not whatsoever.
Did you play in the tournament?
I did not. I mean, it was, you know, the top professionals in the world, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, all those guys were there. So. Nice. Along with the ladies crowd as well. So,
the ladies crowd?
Yeah, Sharapova and Zvonareva tennis player.
I see. Yeah, okay.
See, they are called ladies tennis players. You're allowed to use the term lady. I mean, in some context, I don't think it's appropriate to still talk about women as ladies. But in this context, it's not women's tennis yet, right? Is it ladies?
It feels a little bit like harassing language. Around Fordham, we don't have such things.
We try to be careful with that. That's right, Rick. We got to remember that. And let's remember that tomorrow with Randy, by the way. I know how you like to hug and kiss her and, you know, touch her inappropriately. Please, just lay off that.
Hey, that's okay.
Okay. All right, Chris, what's up with that? What you got for us this week?
All right, well, unsurprisingly, Facebook is the means for yet another controversy regarding teachers and First Amendment rights. The story arises from Mount Dora High School in Central Florida, where high school social studies teacher Jerry Buell was suspended from the classroom for a comment he made against gay marriage. After being legalized in New York State in June, Buell reacted by writing a series of posts emphasizing his personal disgust with the state's decision. But even though he made these comments on his private Facebook page, the school administration didn't hesitate in suspending and reassigning him to administrative duties. What's up with that? Regardless of your opinion on the gay marriage issue, it's absolutely ridiculous that Buell was suspended in this instance. This is a man who's been teaching for 22 years, serves as department chair, and is the reigning teacher of the year. I'm not the only one who feels that way. One of Buell's biggest defenders, believe it or not, is outspoken atheist activist Hermit Mehta. Mehta is a high school math teacher in Illinois, and summed it up when saying that, quote, "You don't have to like what Buell said, I know I don't, but everyone has the right to believe what they want, even if it's crazy, untrue, or harmful," end quote. Apparently that's not the case in Mount Dora, Florida, though, where it seems teachers can't hide what they say privately from Big Brother, even if those views are not articulated in the classroom. After hearing this story, I sure am glad the administrators at the school I taught at didn't see my Facebook posts about Ohio State. But here is yet another example of a prickly First Amendment rights situation handled ever so inconsistently throughout the country. Mike, Rick, what are we to do?
What are we to do? This segment is not "what are we to do." It's "what's up with that?"
You know what? It struck me that it's a shame. It's a shame that Mehta isn't a phys ed teacher, because then we could go metaphysical.
Nice. Or a physics teacher.
But then it'd be metaphysics.
Nice.
I like it.
Right, that's a good one. Yeah, this is interesting. I mean, look, so I assume what? There's people in the school who are offended, you know, trying to make the school tolerant towards gays, et cetera. But it just looks like there's no way that this is going to stand legally, right? I mean, look, are the courts going to uphold this?
I mean, from the looks of things I'm reviewing, it was pretty early on in the decision-making process. They just kind of found out about this, and, you know, he's obviously has hired some lawyers taking the First Amendment standpoint, and they're fighting it right now. But, I mean, I can't really see this holding up compared to, you know, I've brought several of these issues onto the What's Up With That's, and it just, you know, it's something where this guy, you know, is doing something completely in his private life. Yeah. Are teachers not allowed to have their own opinions?
Right. They're not allowed to have their own opinions in school. Sure. I mean, they can't get up and give a speech about their own political views in school if that's against the policy of the school. But, you know, yeah, this seems... you know, these kinds of stories, they also do make a strong case for things like tenure protections. And this is the kind of stuff that unions say, hey, if it weren't for us, these kinds of people would be totally screwed by stupid bureaucrats.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's certainly that. But it's also... You know, this is the point that Neil McCluskey makes every so often, pretty effectively, is that people are going to have legitimate disagreements about these kinds of questions. And I'm not sure that the teacher, you know, I'm not sure that for a teacher to think that or want to share that in their private life ought to be considered out of bounds. But by trying to mandate that we are going to have a district-wide policy on how we're going to handle these issues, we almost ensure that some people, some students, some families, some teachers are going to be in school environments that they are going to find incredibly uncomfortable.
Yep.
And it's not clear to me why we would have a problem with allowing these folks to sort themselves into school environments where they are going to feel comfortable during the academic day.
So segmenting the market is kind of what you're talking about here, Rick.
I'm talking about, I don't believe Tocqueville or Jefferson or Madison ever imagined that in order for democracy to work, we have to squeeze ourselves into a one-size-fits-all set of attitudes towards any number of social relationships.
So you put all the people who are hip to the gays in one school and the people who are not so much in another.
And you allow people to sort themselves into academic environments where they kind of like what happens with like Oberlin and Reed as opposed to Ole Miss and Florida State.
Yep.
That people are permitted to go places where they want to learn.
Or party. Okay, that is all the time we've got for this week. Till next week on the Education Gadfly Show.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.